Many of us would have studied sickle cell disease in an undergraduate genetics course or at high school and possibly recall the striking images of crescent-shaped red blood cells, an iconic feature that gives sickle cell disease its name. From a genetics perspective, sickle cell disease also illustrates some of the fundamental concepts in inheritance, with the disease caused by a single point mutation in the beta globin or HBB gene that is inherited in an autosomal recessive manner. Unfortunately, patients with sickle cell disease also suffer from lifelong complications and reduced life expectancy, in part due to the rigid and sticky nature of the sickle cells that can cause vaso-occlusion, severe pain, organ damage, and unfortunately, increased risk of strokes. One of the more exciting developments in terms of therapy for patients with sickle cell disease has been the recent approval of exogamglogene autostemcel. What a mouthful, but I'm also going to call it exa-cel. And whilst this therapy has been a turning point in the treatment of patients with SCD or sickle cell disease, this is certainly not the first novel therapy, and individuals with sickle cell disease have faced many health inequalities in accessing many of these treatments.
Welcome to the podcast of Hemisphere, the official journal of the European Hematology Association. Hemisphere's podcast presents insightful, expert discussions about recent hematology publications. We hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the Hemisphere podcast. My name is Charles Debock and I'm your host. Today I am joined by Professor Paul Telfer, who is a blood specialist and clinical lead for the hemoglobinopathy services at Barts Health in East London for more than 20 years. Mary Shaniqua, who's an advocacy leader and a person with a lived experience of sickle cell disease. And Stephen Hibbs, who's a hematologist and research fellow at Queen Mary University of London and a scientific editor at Hemisphere, who are all co-authors on a new perspective article in Hemisphere called Health Inequalities in Sickle Cell Disease Be Addressed Through Novel Therapies. And so welcome to you all to the Hemisphere podcast today. And I'm going to launch straight into the first question, and I'd like to start with you, Mary, as a person with a lived experience of sickle cell disease. Can you help us understand the current health challenges faced by people with sickle cell disease and some of the treatments that are accessible and available to you? So welcome to you all. Mary, if I could start with you as a person with a lived experience of sickle cell disease, and can you help us understand the current health challenges faced by people with sickle cell disease and the treatments available and accessible to you?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Often when people think of sickle cell disease, they think of pain and the pain crisis, and that being the focus almost of the impact of the illness. But the reality is that sickle cell impacts every facet of life for the sickle cell patient. I don't want to underestimate the realities of living with a condition that causes a sporadic pain and really severe pain. But there are other ways in which sickle cell impacts in terms of longer term damage caused by the illness, in terms of organs or bone damage, the result and then the impact of that in terms of chronic pain as opposed to just acute pain. And there's also issues with the eyes and as you rightly pointed out, the risk of stroke. And they're just such a myriad of things that this illness can cause. And as a result of all of those things, the way it impacts one socially and in the workplace, physically and within family and so on and so forth, it really does impact every facet of life. In terms of treatments, so at the moment, there are two main treatments more widely available, and those are either some form of blood transfusion, be that blood exchange or topical transfusion and so on, or there are the hydrocarbamide or hydroxyurea, different names, tablets or medication rather, available. There are other treatments, bone marrow transplant and so on, curative therapies, but those come at high costs. I mean, even so, I'm based in the UK. In the UK, we have free healthcare under the NHS. Treatments like that are not available to all sickle patients. So often people hear about these developments in science and say, well, that's it. It's sorted now. Sickle cell patients have a cure and it's all going to be better. And it just doesn't work that way. And so I guess the difficulty for the majority of patients who are able to access these treatments is being able to access the blood transfusion option that they need, or the dealing with the side effects and so on that comes along with taking the hydroxyurea.
Right. If I can just focus in on the pain, you know, I didn't realize that myself. Like, how debilitating is the pain? Are we talking like just a mild headache, or are we talking about like where you're a kind of catatonic state where you go, this is it, I'm in acute pain, is that like require pain relief or is it just you've just got to wait for it to pass?
So the pain, I often try to describe it in, I try to use a visual of a tarantula to help and people understand the pain. So if you think of a tarantula, it's like this really hairy spider. So if you just imagine on the end of all of those hairs, there are daggers, and then you place that tarantula inside the epicenter of the bone, and it's not one of them. It's thousands of them, and they're all dancing to their own rhythm, up and down, side to side, and that pain, that stabbing pain radiating out from the epicenter of the bone right the way through to the skin surface. It is definitely the worst pain I've experienced, and I've had the fortune of experiencing some really severe medical issues, you know, like pulmonary embolism and so on and so forth. And in fact, I've had situations where serious things like that, I'm smiling, it's not a joke, where serious things like that get almost missed or dismissed by me because the pain isn't severe enough, because it doesn't compare to sickle cell crisis pain. So the pain really is really severe, and that's the acute pain. Chronic pain is also a pain in the backside as well, something that over time, particularly where sickle has caused long-term damage in the patient, so, you know, avascular necrosis and so on, you have to learn to live with that chronic pain. The acute pain happens annoyingly sporadically, but not all the time, whereas the chronic pain is just constant. It doesn't stop. It doesn't disappear.
And there's no, you don't even know when it's coming. It just hits you.
Like yes,
you
can't even
predict when it's going to happen.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So not great in terms of living with SCD.
No.
And perhaps on that note, I'm going to move to Paul, who's had over 20 years of experience with patients with sickle cell disease and an expert on hemoglobinopathies, also on lots of clinical advisory groups. How have you seen the therapies change over time, over your career? And where are we now in terms of the national and international guidelines to manage the patients with sickle cell disease, having just heard what Mary has described as some of the symptoms?
Yeah, thanks. And thanks, Mary. I mean, that's a really graphic description of living with sickle cell. And I think you've kind of highlighted what my experience is as well of trying to help and manage people living with the condition, that it is so varied, but a lot of severe complications. And of course, we all focus on pain because we see patients coming in day by day in a pain crisis. And we need to manage, you can't leave somebody in pain, and you need to manage that pain straight away. But there are many other complications, and it's a very bewildering condition because not everybody has the same complications at the same time. And this is one of the challenges for us in kind of studying the condition as well, is to kind of understand how some people are affected in different ways. But I think everybody living with sickle cell is affected in one way or another, within that great deal of variability. I think the striking thing to me is the lack of treatments available. And that is one of the reasons why we have these challenges. And some people get into problems of having to access the hospital so much, you know, for pain management, developing chronic pain. And it's because we're not doing well enough really in controlling the condition. And if we had decent treatments, I think, you know, the things would be much different. And so over the time that I've been working in the field, really for the majority of that time, we've only had these two treatment options. So one of them is a oral medication called hydroxycarbamide, or hydroxyurea, as it's known in many parts of the world. It's easy to take. It requires monitoring because it can suppress the blood counts. And for some people, it can be very effective in controlling the frequency and the severity of the pain episodes, and can have some modifying effect on the long-term effects of the condition as well. Although that probably needs more study, exactly how much effect that's having in preventing problems in the long term. There have been concerns about the adverse effects of hydroxycarbamide. And I think quite rightly, the community has been concerned about the effect on fertility, the effects perhaps on the blood stem cells and the function. And I think that concern has been shared by clinicians as well. But because of the number of studies and because of the length of follow-up now of people who have been taking hydroxycarbamide, I think most of us are reassured that although there are side effects. These are manageable, and the net effect of hydroxycarbamide for most people is very much positive in terms of controlling the condition. However, if we had other treatments available, this would make it a lot richer in terms of treatment choices. And I think we would be able better to address the concerns of many people, because I have this issue quite frequently in clinic, particularly with my adult patients, that they don't feel comfortable about taking hydroxycarbamide. And there is a narrative which continues about that it's not effective, or that it has very bad side effects. So although we need to dispel some of that concern, I think it is nevertheless remains very important to develop new treatments. The second treatment that has been available for many, many, many years is blood transfusion. And blood transfusion works because essentially you're replacing the sickle blood with blood that doesn't sickle from a blood donor. And by giving a blood transfusion, you improve the anemia, the low red blood cell count that is a feature of the condition, but you also suppress the sickle hemoglobin production by suppressing the production of blood in the bone marrow. So it can be a very effective treatment, and there are several clinical trials showing its benefit, particularly in children with problems related to the nervous system. So children who have had strokes or who are at risk of stroke, there's very good evidence that blood transfusion works, but it's been used in many other situations. And these days, we tend to deliver transfusion in the form of exchange transfusion, where we take blood out as well as giving it. So that, and that can be done using apheresis machine with automated exchange transfusion. And we have many patients who are having this treatment every 6 weeks. It's quite a burden. My patients accept it because they feel generally a lot better, and they feel more confident that their condition is under control. However, transfusion isn't for everybody, and we run into particularly problems related to long-term transfusion with iron overload. But even more of a problem for us, I think, is alloimmunization and the risk of transfusion reactions. And we're seeing more and more of this problem. And sometimes these reactions can be very severe. So transfusion is an important treatment. It is approved in the form of exchange transfusion by NICE. So that's the National Institute of Healthcare Excellence in the UK for our healthcare service. So we are able to deliver an apheresis service. But having said all that, you know, there are the need for more treatments, and ultimately we want a cure. And I think that comes across very loud and clear in most of my consultations, that patients, although they benefit from some form of treatment, the treatment is tiresome, and what they really want is a long-term control of the condition. So the option of some form of stem cell transplant using a donor, or of a gene therapy approach where you're using your own blood stem cells, which are genetically manipulated in some way, are very welcome. And this is a very exciting period of time where we're beginning to deliver these treatments, certainly in our healthcare system.
Absolutely. Because every 6 weeks a blood transfusion, and if it's a child, it's not a pop in, pop out. I'm guessing, how long does the child have to be in the clinic? So that's a lot of time in the service as well, which you said is a burden.
And for
those of us who don't know, the hydroxycarbamide, that tablet, is that daily or weekly or monthly? How often
daily.
Do you take that?
Daily. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I mean, so you have to remember.
Oral medication, but as many of the audience will know, it's been around for 100 years or more, and it was synthesized as a form of chemotherapy drug and has been used to manage chronic blood malignancies. But it works in a specific way in sickle cell, which we don't fully understand, to enhance fetal hemoglobin production, as well as some other actions as well. And the net effect is that it is still the most effective oral treatment that we have available for sickle cell.
So that was a nice segue from Paul, because we mentioned fetal hemoglobin and NICE, which is the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence. And they've just approved a new gene therapy product called Exagam Glogene Autotemcel. Again, I don't know why they have these ridiculously long names, but also called Exa-cel. And this is for use in some people with sickle cell disease. And Stephen, if I can turn to you now to give us a bit of background about what this therapy is and who's eligible and why this is such a major turning point for the therapy of sickle cell disease.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Charlie. Yes. So maybe just starting with what it is and what it does. So I'm going to call it Exa-cel, the short version of the name. So Exa-cel what it is, someone living with sickle cell or thalassemia, actually, because it's used there in that patient group as well, but I'm going to focus here on people living with sickle cell. So they will have their own stem cells harvested, generally mobilized into their peripheral blood, taken and then ex vivo edited, so edited outside of the body. This isn't like there's some types of gene therapy where you actually give the gene therapy product directly and then that edits within the person's body. That's not what's happening here. So this is ex vivo. And what it's doing, so it's using CRISPR-Cas9, which is sometimes described as molecular scissors. So they change the genetic code. They don't actually change it at the point of the sickle cell mutation. That's sometimes a misunderstanding. So it's not actually changing someone's genetic code to get rid of the mutation that leads to sickle cell disease. But what they're doing is editing a region called BCL11A, which is the promoter of hemoglobin F. So there's a lot of jargon there. So if I just try and break that down briefly, this is the part of the genetic code that regulates, turns on and off the production of the type of blood that a person makes when they're still a fetus, so still in the womb. And the really good thing about that is, first of all, that hemoglobin isn't affected by the sickle cell mutation. So it draws on a different part of the genetic code when it's taking the different chains. So the beta chain that normally would have the sickle cell mutation in it, it doesn't draw on that. It draws on a different chain that's not affected by the sickle cell mutation. But the second thing is that hemoglobin F, so your fetal hemoglobin, has in itself these anti-sickling properties. So it resists some of the polymerization, some of the sort of fundamental effect that the sickle hemoglobin is having on red blood cells. And so therefore, the way that it acts is to really boost up someone's hemoglobin F levels in a way that even in those who respond brilliantly to hydroxycarbamide, aren't going to reach these levels of hemoglobin F. So hemoglobin F is massively upregulated. And what we know that that does is to then really reduce a huge number of the at least short and probably medium-term complications of sickle cell disease. We don't know about long-term yet. We've only got a few years of follow-up data on people who've been treated with this. But what you can see really strikingly is the lack of things like acute painful crises, acute chest crises. And we hope, as data kind of becomes more mature, that we might also see a reduction in some of the long-term organ damage that can really, over time, become some of the biggest problems of sickle cell. So that's a kind of brief explanation of how it works. So, I should say as well, that happens outside the body. And then to get those cells back in the body, and this is really important, actually, because this is still probably the messiest part of the process. What one then has to do is to make space for those cells using conditioning regimens. So that's what you do in any other type of bone marrow transplant. It's using things like chemotherapy, radiotherapy, different ways to create the space back in the bone marrow to reinfuse these cells. And probably at the moment, in terms of the risks and the toxicity of the treatment, that's the main toxic bit, is the conditioning that's given to allow the product to come back into the body. And then that re-engrafts. And someone stays in hospital while that's re-engrafting and then needs kind of intensive follow-up in the early days of that. And then hopefully over time, the follow-up becomes less and less. So it's sort of similar in some ways to the effect of a allogeneic bone marrow transplant, but you don't need a matched donor. And also the big thing that it means that you avoid is the problems of graft versus host disease that are possible in an allogeneic donor. So then just briefly, who can have it? On the NHS, it's restricted to people of a certain age. And so at the moment, that is people below 35 or 40. It's in younger adults living with sickle cell who don't have a matched sibling donor. Because if you have a matched sibling donor, then that's seen as equivalently a good treatment and is more cost effective. It's not in people with hemoglobin SC, and that is probably a bit of a problem here. And that reflects the clinical trial data, because that's the clinical trials didn't involve people with hemoglobin SC. But I think people with SC rightly can feel a little like their disease is being minimized sometimes, because SC can be extremely severe. It has different rates of complications compared to other genotypes of sickle cell disease. But the fact that we can't offer this treatment to people with severe SC at the moment is a bit of a problem. And then there's plenty of different comorbidities and problems that would also mean that someone wasn't eligible for this. But I think just to return to the final part of your question is, why is this a big deal? Maybe I'll just highlight a couple of things briefly. One is, it can be absolutely life-changing for individuals who receive it. And yeah, really can be transformative. I, I think the word curative is a word that's so loaded with hope, and whether or not that's the right word yet, we don't know, but it's transformative, definitely. I think the second thing is it's a treatment developed specifically for people living with sickle cell disease. And I think there's something quite symbolically important about that, after having years and years and years where essentially what you're having is repurposed treatments from other disease situations. As we say, hydroxycarbamide, brilliant drug, but repurposed. Transfusion therapy, even exchange transfusion, developed in other patient groups and other diseases first, repurposed. This is a groundbreaking treatment that is developed for people living with hemoglobinopathies, thalassemia, and sickle cell. There's a real symbolic importance to that, I think, both for people living with sickle cell, but also for those working in the area of sickle cell, that it gives you this hope that, okay, like, we're not maybe being left behind in the same way that we felt for so many years, where you see, you know, the 100th treatment for this blood cancer. And not to underrate that, brilliant to have new treatments coming through, but to be actually starting to see something change here. So I think there's both that individual importance, but there's also the symbolic importance of a new high-tech, specifically designed treatment.
But of course, with high-tech comes cost, and you mentioned that. And I think if I looked at the numbers, there are 17,000 people in the UK with sickle cell disease. And if I'm right, only about 50 people will be treated annually, which isn't a great deal. It's great for those 50, but as you said, so before I move to the next question, I was going to quickly pop over to Paul. I mean, you're on the advisory panel for some of these things, and the age limit is 35 to 40. Is that a cost-saving measure, or is that a clinical, I don't know, that sounds really terrible, cost-saving measure where you said, okay, we only want to, you know, treat people under the age of 40 because the people over 40, they're not going to contribute to our society. That's a very cynical approach. Or is it really the stem cells which you can harvest and the quality of the stem cells, that's what predicts the best chance for exa-cel actually working?
It's a good question. So this is quite a reasonable decision about age. I mean, just to be clear, the licensing doesn't specify the age of 35-40, but this is a decision that about the age limit that we've come to, because when we decide on people going forward for gene therapy, this is based on a regional and national medical committee decision within our NHS commissioning. The data from the clinical trials, the exclusion criteria in the clinical trial, this was the CLIMB 121 study, was age 35 or over. You could be 35, but not over the age of 35. So it is really based on a conservative view of the clinicians that we don't have data on people over that age. So at this stage, we want to be careful. And it's also bearing in mind that, as Stephen said, this is not a light treatment. It involves what we call myeloablation with busulfan at the moment. So you're giving a very hefty dose of chemotherapy, which is sterilizing, but is also potentially quite toxic. And there have been significant toxicities in the study and in the real world experience with busulfan, particularly veno-occlusive disease in the sickle and thalassemia programs. So I think we're being very careful about that. And I think that is probably correct at this stage. The other thing to say is that it's not very easy to collect hematopoietic stem cells in adults with sickle cell. And that has been a challenge in the clinical trial, and I think is being seen in the clinical practice as well, that we're a bit limited about the mobilizing agents we can use, and the number of CD34 positive blood stem cells, the quality of those stem cells when they've been through the manufacturing process can be a challenge. So this is a very early stage of the rollout of this program, and there are some things that we need to kind of work on a little
bit. Follow up on, yeah, absolutely. Well, maybe that's a nice segue, because although this is a new therapy, there's actually been two other novel therapies for sickle cell disease. And again, names, I'm going to attempt to say them. The first one is crizanlizumab, or as Mary so eloquently said, we just call it Criz, and everybody knows what we're talking about, and voxelotor. But these were withdrawn after a very short period of time. And so, Stephen, if I could go back to you first, and then I'm going to go to you, Mary. But Stephen, what has been the impact of having these therapies and then having them withdrawn in terms of the clinical side and the practice when you're seeing patients with sickle cell disease?
Thanks, Charlie. We started writing the perspectives article in Hemisphere after the withdrawal of crizanlizumab, which was in January of 2024. And we kind of were trying to get our heads around, you know, what what is the impact of this? And actually, it took us more than a year. It was close to a year and a half by the time we ended up publishing it. And part of the reason for that was so much changed over that time. So we sort of wrote something about that. And then Voxelotor got approved. And then just as we were getting our heads around that, Voxelotor got withdrawn. And then just as we were getting our heads around that, Exacel, which had already been rejected by NICE, then got approved. In terms of what was actually going on the ground for people experiencing this, it was really chaotic. And I think just to give a brief overview of those two withdrawals. So crizanlizumab had been approved by NICE in October 2022, and its license was revoked in January of 2024 on the basis of the phase three results. So the phase two clinical trials looked very promising, and then phase three full results showed no effect. And actually, at that point, it was just based on abstract data. The full results didn't come out till actually this year. And that was on the basis of lack of effect seen, possibly due to the patient selection, possibly due to the endpoints chosen. Perhaps there is still some utility to the drug, but there wasn't enough that was seen in phase three, and so it was withdrawn. And the Voxelotor was even more sudden. So that was actually about a year ago. I remember at the ASCAT conference, sickle cell and thalassemia meeting, it was, I think, the week of pretty much the withdrawal of Voxelotor, based on some excess deaths seen in the Voxelotor arm of some of the parts of the clinical trials looking at Voxelotor. And it was withdrawn suddenly based on those events. And they, I think, had to respond to what they were seeing there. But it's taken a very long time to get any further detail of exactly what that was. And I think at the time as well, one of the big things that struck me, and I should say that I haven't been over the last 2 years the person on the ground clinically, but what I have been doing is a ethnographic research study. I'm spending time amongst people living with sickle cell and also clinicians. And what I was struck by for the clinicians was the position that they were put in, actually. I'll let Mary speak more to the experience of people living with sickle cell. I saw that a lot as well, of people saying, what's going on here? People struggling to get back onto the chronic exchange transfusion therapy they've been on before because they've been put on a therapy and now they're being withdrawn, so they didn't have access to that. But even from the clinician point of view, what do you do when one day you've got a patient who's, you've gone through quite careful discussions about, we're going to, you know, go on to this, this is what we know, this is what we don't know, and then suddenly it's withdrawn off the market like that? And actually, there were clinicians as well as people living with sickle cell who were hearing it on the news before they heard it through official channels because it was so sudden. You know, Pfizer just withdrew it within, I think there might have been an alert. It was no more than 24 hours from what I understand, to some of the people involved, but it really was so sudden. The questions were, what do we do? How do we safely take people off? Do we taper? Do we stop suddenly? So I think that sense of just being unsure about how you manage the fallout of just for the individuals involved, let alone then the kind of impact on trust, the impact on what's going to happen next time a novel therapy comes out. How do you communicate that with Ken?
Absolutely. I think, you know, and Mary, please, like, this sounds like a massive roller coaster when you've got all this coming on. You're given the promise of a new therapy which can alleviate some of the symptoms or side effects from the current therapies. You move to it, then you're withdrawn. I mean, how is that for the community? And maybe you can walk us through some of the impacts.
So it's really difficult. The first thing to remember is the two treatments that we spoke about earlier, blood transfusion and hydroxyurea. If we focus on blood transfusion for now, because as Paul rightly highlighted, there's such a reluctance in the adult and patient base around hydroxyurea and the longer term impact or side effects of the medication. If we look at blood transfusion, it's reliant firstly on blood donation and the need for the blood donation from particular groups, like ethnic groups within society. Where we are at the moment is that blood donation levels are low. So what that means is even with patients with sickle cell who are on Voxelotor and Criz, there's already a struggle for access to blood products for the sickle patient base on blood transfusion and treatment. And so the sudden withdrawal of both of those treatments then compounds the issue further because there isn't enough blood products for the patient base. And so what that does mean is those patients who were on those treatments end up on a sort of almost waiting list or are unable to get the access to the blood transfusion treatments at the speed and pace that they would need it. One of the first issues against the backdrop of that, the emotional toil for the patient who has a medication today and tomorrow that medication is just withdrawn. Firstly, you think about the reasons given are about the high rate of death in usage of these medications. Well, you've already taken it. So there's that to contend with. Is it going to impact me in some way? And that can also lead the patient to, I don't want to use the term hypochondriac because it makes it sound like they are making a big deal out of nothing. It is really concerning if the creator of this medication is saying that it has caused significantly high numbers of death in a particular patient base, and you sit within that patient base. So contending with that psychologically can be really difficult. When I was trying to explain it to my colleagues at the time, at work, was imagine, you know, we all use, I'm trying to think, paracetamol or ibuprofen, and then imagine tomorrow it's just not available. Like you have a headache and you can't access paracetamol or ibuprofen. There isn't anywhere to go. And so the psychological impact and the trust breakdown, you know, you're talking about a patient base that, as we've already heard, have very limited treatments made for them. So often we feel, forgotten about. And I remember some years back at a hospital that I was speaking at, and they made it clear that the hematology and oncology services together, but really the hematology gets the leftover, so to speak, of the oncology service. And so that I use that as a almost a metaphor to explain the sickle patient base. We're often forgotten. We're often like left to the side, and you get the repurposed drugs and treatments, which is great. There's a feeling of people are not in the lab looking for solutions for us and to help us and so on. So you think of all of that background and the trust element there for the patient base, it does break down. And that becomes really difficult because we already have an issue with willingness of sickle patients to, you know, participate in clinical trials and so on. And I'm also part of that problem. I also have the same trust issues. And so, you know, just seeing that play out, the patient base psychologically and the longer term impact on what that means for medical treatments moving forward, I don't know how we resolve that, if I'm entirely honest.
Yeah, this is a great way to go back to Paul, perhaps, because you're on some of these advisory panels. In terms of the clinical evidence, which was available at the time of the approval for Voxelotor and Criz, how much evidence do you need to see at the approval side when you give like the go or no go for a therapy for sickle cell disease in terms of the evidence of efficacy? And what is the risk appetite of the advisory panel when it comes to approval, when there are limited treatment options? And, you know, this is an example, but then is it worse now that it's taken that, you know, the rug is pulled out from under the feet of SCD patients? So perhaps on your side, where do you sit on the advisory panel?
So I served on kind of as a medical advisor on some of these panels, particularly for NICE. I think I'm allowed to say that. And I guess that I'm not the one who makes the decision, and anybody can actually read about how NICE approaches and health technology assessment too. And basically what they're doing is they're making an evaluation of whether a treatment is good value for money for the health service. So in a way, there are two kind of licensing bits. That there's the kind of legal licensing, which in the UK, that's what we call the MHRA. In the European Union, it's the EMA, isn't it? The European Medicines Agency. So a drug needs to be, first of all, approved, have a licensing approval. I've not really been involved in that in that side of things, but that licensing approval is fairly readily given to these new treatments. And I think it's more based on the safety and efficacy as well. But for NICE, and this would be the same in other countries as well, there has to be some additional panel that makes a decision about, okay, you've got a limited amount of money to spend on healthcare across all conditions. If there is a treatment that is going to cost a vast amount of money, how do you make a decision about using that treatment, which might exclude somebody else from being able to access a cheaper treatment, maybe for another condition? So this is the way that NICE considers the evidence. And so it's actually very thorough. And as well as sort of assessing the efficacy, the safety, there is a very thorough health economic assessment. And that is done by the company, but also the health economic panel that's appointed by NICE. And it's really very, very much to make an estimate of the benefit against the cost for the health service. And there's an awful lot of uncertainty about that, because there are a lot of unknowns, even in when you've got kind of good quality trial data. So one of the things that became very apparent to me with the sickle cell is that we don't really have enough data on the long-term outcomes with sickle cell without treatment, and how much it's costing the health service and how it's affecting people. Because the costs have to include, you know, how it's affecting people and the costs to the individual of the conditions. A quality adjusted life year. But NICE keep saying this, that they don't have good quality data on outcomes. So it makes the estimate very difficult. And that was one of the challenges. So when we go to these individual treatments, although there were some similarities in that they were both approved and then withdrawn, the reasons for the withdrawal were different. And I think in the case of crizanizumab, it was because they made the decision to approve based on interim evidence, if you like. So there was the results of the phase 2 study, which was quite small, but the drug company had intended to go and do a phase 3 study, which means a very big study, randomized control study, looking at the really quantifying the efficacy. And that was the condition that NICE actually approved it, that they would then reassess based on the phase 3 data. So the phase 3 study, very surprisingly, showed that there was actually no difference between placebo and drug in terms of efficacy. So I think it would be difficult for any licensing authority to spend a very large amount of money, of health service money, that could be used for another treatment where the efficacy has been shown, where the definitive study has not shown a benefit. And so I think that has to be understood in the case of crizanizumab. And I think the issue there was whether the approval was done too early. And Stephen really has made this point in the article. But the effect on the patients has been very considerable, because before the withdrawal, many patients were put on crizanizumab in a managed access scheme. And some of them benefited, not all of them. And some of them actually got worse, but some of them definitely did benefit. And so it was a big, big shock when that was withdrawn, but it's understandable in a way why that's the case. In the case of Voxelotor, and I was involved from very early on actually in developing this drug, and it was purposed specifically for sickle cells. The initial company that developed it were looking at a specific small molecule that would influence hemoglobin and to prevent the sickling. And it went through animal studies, volunteer studies, phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 studies, which showed a benefit, which had been accepted as being sufficient to approve. And over that time, myself and many other clinicians had started using Voxelotor and had seen some patients do extremely well on it. Some patients had been treated for more than 5 years in various parts of this trial. But very suddenly, Stephen said, it was withdrawn, and that was on a drug company decision based on some signals from two small studies, which was predominantly conducted in Africa, but undeniably showed a difference between the controls who were on the dummy drug and the patients in terms of mortality. So there were more deaths in the placebo-controlled trial in the patients on the active treatment. Not quite clear why, but I think they felt that they had no choice but to withdraw it on that basis. There was some additional evidence from an American registry, which actually in retrospect turns out not to have been valid, or not to have been accurate analysis of the data, suggesting that people had more pain episodes while on Voxelotor. But that, I think, is uncertain. So there is this slight question mark, but I think many of us felt that we had, and Mary mentioned this, that we have treated many patients with Voxelotor for quite a long period of time, and their lives had been quite transformed because they had better hemoglobin levels, less jaundice, less tiredness, and they hadn't been able to tolerate anything else. And then to suddenly withdraw it so that it was actually not even licensed, so legally not available, was a very dramatic thing to do. And in that case, of course, NICE had no choice but to withdraw because the drug isn't even licensed now. So there's slightly different circumstances, but both contribute to this story of the need for more treatments, the need to do things and to perhaps not to cut corners, but to facilitate the access of new treatments when you don't have all of the data. But then you run into a problem where when the data is not favorable, you're in a very difficult situation.
So, Stephen, you mentioned that sometimes the patients heard the news of these withdrawals on the news before the clinician could actually relay that news to the patients on the drugs. And you kind of mentioned in your article as well about the communication on these approvals and subsequent withdrawals needs to be improved. And what can we learn from this so this isn't really repeated?
Yeah. I mean, we have spent a lot of time thinking about this. And I think as Paul's described so clearly, there's the actual when is something ready to approve or not. It's such a fine-tuned debate. And there's so many factors that come into it. And I definitely don't feel any authority to kind of give an opinion on that. And I think even within our group, we felt differently actually on this, of some people leaning towards saying accelerated approval still on balance is a better thing. And some people saying actually accelerated approval, i.e. approval when you've still only got interim data or you're not sure the harms outweigh the benefits. There's different feelings on that. But I think that if we are going to continue in doing what is being done sort of at the moment, which is leaning towards accelerated approval, then I think probably the three big things. One is at the moment of approval, there's such a good reason to want to have a moment of public celebration. And that's partly because it's good news, you know, it's always good to celebrate, but it's also because I think sickle cell itself is symbolic of so many other deeply problematic inequities built into society. There's the racialized aspect of sickle cell. There's the way in which it has been neglected and in many ways continues to be neglected. And so many reasons why there's almost like a collective sigh of like, yes, we're moving forward, we've got somewhere. But it's that sort of desire to celebrate and perhaps celebrate too securely that then comes back to amplify the sense of damage if and when that then is withdrawn. And so I think probably our first thing would just be to say all of us probably have a role to play in this, clinicians, patient advocates, healthcare organizations, to temper that celebration perhaps, as much as that itself is sad and I wish we could be more able to celebrate freely. I think there's something there. I think secondly, in the individual discussions with people who are considering these medications, to find tools and ways, and perhaps there's a research question here really of how do we best within the sickle cell patient group specifically discuss novel therapies with this particular aspect of data that's not yet mature and therefore the risk of uncertainty and to better manage those sort of uncertainties ahead of time. And then I think the third thing then is really a question to pharmaceutical companies, and we have raised this with them since we published this article, to say what's your role in this, what's your role both in terms of how you market these medications, but also if and when medications are withdrawn, does your responsibility to an individual patient who's been on your medication end at that point? Does it? I don't know the answer to this, but I feel like there maybe is actually something of aftercare, that's a word that we use in the article, probably not directly to that patient, but through the teams that are managing patients, to provide a bit more capacity to actually deal with the fallout better than what happened, particularly in the case of Oxelotor. There's probably lots of legal reasons that I don't understand why that makes it difficult for pharmaceutical companies to do that. But I do think there's a question there of saying, can there be better aftercare if and when this is to happen again in future. So I think those would be three of the main lessons that we collectively felt it was worth articulating.
I agree. I think you've articulated that nicely. You almost said, if you have drug A and that doesn't work and we're going to approve it, you need a plan B out there. So in the instance where it's pulled out, you know, what else is going to happen in terms of their clinical management? I mean, Mary, what are your thoughts? You've seen this happen now and the promise of a new therapy, which we often conflate with like new is better. And in this case, new wasn't better. Perhaps maybe we'll see Voxelotor return. If there's more, I don't know if there's going to be more trials that might come back. And then it's going to be, can we trust Voxelotor again after the first instance? We never know, as you said, if there's a risk of higher mortality, are you willing to, you know, balance that off? So where would you like improvements to be made in terms of the communication and steps forward for sickle cell disease?
So I agree with the three highlight points that Stephen has pointed out. I think in future, I would like to see. So I am conflicted when it comes to accelerated approval, but in the instance that is the path that we go down, which is where I think things will go based on where we are now, I guess I would just like to see, and I appreciate in terms of studying medication and research and developing medication, there's a lot of reliance on data, but I would implore pharmaceutical companies to just remember that those data are people, real people with lives, you know, people's sons and daughters and mothers and fathers and so on. And so I would implore them to think about the personhood of the data, so to speak, of the patient base and how to protect against that. So Stephen used the term aftercare, which I really like. I'm not expecting pharmaceutical companies to begin a new plans and strategies for the patient base. But something about the way in which that information is communicated, something about the psychological impact on the patient and having, I don't know if it's funding given towards that or some, I don't know how pharmaceutical companies are run. I can't speak to that. But what I do know is if we do want to progress treatment and research in sickle cell disease, we do need to have a trust amongst the patient base and the pharmaceutical companies. And I think the pharmaceutical company does need to almost extend the olive branch or bridge that gap to help the patient base in trusting them longer term.
Absolutely. Well, look, we're kind of coming to the end of the discussion, really. I'd implore the listeners of this podcast to read the article because it's outstanding. We haven't touched on all of the points. One of the things which, Stephen, you did mention was that all this investment in new therapies, and we should be investing in familiar therapies like the transfusion medicine because that's successful, it's there, it's possible. And I'm always like conflicted as well with that because it shouldn't be an either or choice. You know, I know we're in a resource limited setting where there's money, we can't splash money on everything, but an ideal situation, you know, we'd like to have familiar therapies, backup therapies, novel therapies, addressing a real unmet need. One of the key points is, you know, and we didn't mention this outright, is that most people living with sickle cell disease identify as Black African or Black Caribbean. And I think, as you said, the inequities of a rare disease and the trust of the health system is all compounding right together. It's like I'm a crisis there about where do you turn when you have all these different choices and whether you're getting the best care, et cetera. So if we were to look in the future, and I'm going to have this as the last question, what do you each believe is the most critical step for healthcare organizations and the wider community to prioritize in terms of the health inequalities for people with SCD? And say like in 10 years time, 10 years from now, where would you like to see the healthcare and management of people with sickle cell disease be?
10 years from now, I would like to see, I think the most important thing to me is that the patient is believed. And so when the patient presents with a sickle cell crisis, that they are treated as equitably and safely as all other patient bases, that any presuppositions or preconceived notions about the patient based on how they present, race, age, gender, and so on, fall away. And I think if we can address that, the familiar therapies, they'll have great promise. The issue we have as sickle patients, or at least from our perspective, the issue we have is almost a need to, or at least a feeling that you need to perform or meet a particular criteria. It's almost like respectability politics to be treated in a way that, you know, it doesn't matter how someone presents, whether someone is rich or homeless or white or black, it should not matter. At the point in which one needs healthcare intervention, that intervention should be the same across the board, irrespective of difference or how one presents. Years from now, I would really hope that we don't have to continue beating that same drum, and that sickle cell patients are being treated fairly and equally and getting the right treatments that they are well entitled to based on the NICE guidelines and so on. That would, I hope, make a big difference for the patient base.
That's very powerful. I hope it doesn't take 10 years for that. I hope it takes 1 year, because I think it's outrageous sometimes that is required.
Mm.
Stephen, maybe I'll turn to you and then final with Paul. Stephen, where would you like to see the treatment 10 years' time? I know that's a long horizon, but let's be ambitious. Curative exercise for everybody.
Yeah, no, I think maybe I'll touch on, it's such a big question, and Mary's already identified something utterly critical. Perhaps I'll touch just on something slightly different. I'd like to see the availability of what we already know works at a sort of life saving level. And that's things like being identified at birth and access to prophylactic antibiotics and basic level care available to everyone with sickle cell worldwide. And we haven't really talked about this today, but still, if we actually, you know, you mentioned earlier, Charlie, that there's at least 17,000 people with sickle cell living in the UK, probably a few thousand more. We don't even have perfect data on exactly how many. 50 of them a year make XSL brilliant. Let's ramp that up. But actually, let's look more broadly across the world. There are millions and millions and millions of people living with sickle cell across the world. And the majority of them are living in low and middle income countries. And many of them still won't live to their fifth birthday. That's preventable by effective newborn screening programs and by early simple measures like vaccinations, daily penicillin. So yeah, there's so many things that I hope for, but I think in 10 years time, if we had a even in places with the most kind of difficulty in getting the basics done well, like Democratic Republic of Congo and other areas of the world where with very high prevalence of sickle cell and very fragile healthcare systems, that would be a fantastic 10 years of progress.
Excellent. Paul, 20 years in the game, you've got another 10 years to go. Where would you like things to go?
Okay. Well, I mean, it is a huge question, but I think I'm going to assume that there will be a continued pipeline of new treatments. And I mean, it's not enough. And if you sort of think about, I don't know, hepatitis C or HIV, I think huge advances have been made and we haven't really hit that yet, the sort of the real, real control of the condition. But I would just go back to the basics of care and in the health service, like Mary was saying, we still have by no means got this right. And this is highlighted in the No One's Listening report, which some of us will be familiar with, which came about after an adverse event affecting a patient in our healthcare system. But essentially, we haven't got a good enough consistent pathway in place to manage everybody who attends hospital with a pain crisis and giving them compassionate and effective and safe care every time. And I think that that is a challenge for our healthcare system, which we are trying to address. I think it needs ambulatory care units and specialized same-day units, which needs some investment, but it's eminently possible. And I've been campaigning about this for a long time. And I think also providing holistic and specialist care with a more community-based setting as well would be really good. It's too much of it. This happens in the hospital. And sickle cell is a long-term condition. We should be going out and providing this care in community centers, specialist care in community centers. And this, again, is part of the NHS plan, and it has to be applied to sickle cell. We are getting some investment to do that now, but the model of care hasn't yet been properly evaluated. But I think that that acute care pathway, every time getting it right, and providing holistic specialized care in a community setting, which is better, more convenient for the patient, I think is what we need.
I started off with talking about our high school years when we looked at these sickle cell disease, the pictures, like more just as a novelty. Mary, your description about the pain as being profound, I had no idea, to be honest, about that. And as a fundamental researcher who uses CRISPR-Cas on a daily basis to do genetic engineering. And I was super excited about exa-cel and about, wow, this is cool, you know, switching on fetal hemoglobin. This is a game changer. But now after reading this Perspective article, there's so much unintended consequences around that discovery and the rollout for patients with sickle cell disease without providing false hope, but having strong pipelines of new therapies. And I would just like to, again, encourage all our listeners to take the time to read this Perspective if you're a clinician. If you're a basic researcher, read it as well, because it shows you how your fundamental research can lead to a fundamental new cell therapy, but also the consequence of rolling that out. It's not just a, you know, that's the end of the story. It's the next steps about rolling it out to as many patients as possible. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Paul. And thanks to all our listeners. And join us next time for the next Hemisphere podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hemisphere podcast. All of Hemisphere's content is open access and can be found at www.hemispherejournal.com. We hope you will join us for future podcast episodes.